bloody neck.
There is blood, though, Mr. Gaines, coming out of her mouth, interrupted Kefauver, outraged. A little, Gaines said, to a smattering of titters in the crowd. I apologize for interjecting, Mr. Chairman, Kefauver said, turning to Hendrickson.
That's quite all right. I yield to you, sir.
But before Kefauver could proceed, Gaines asked for a moment of time. Senator Kefauver, I would like to correct the record on something Dr. Wortham said about one of our comics earlier today. He cited one of our comics as extolling bigotry. Nothing could be further from the truth.
When was this, Mr. Gaines? Asked Kefauver.
Earlier he testified that we had a comic using ethnic slurs for Mexicans, as if we were promoting prejudice. We were not. The story in question, which ran in Criminal Comics issue number 173 in August 1951, was making the point that bigotry was evil and stupid. The racist boss is the clear bad guy, while the braceros who rise up against him are the heroes.
I see, said Kefauver.
Mr. Chairman, said Charlie, may I ask a question or two of the witness?
If the senator from Tennessee is willing to yield, said Hendrickson.
With delight, said Kefauver.
Mr. Gaines, I'm Charlie Martyr, the congressman from this district. I recognize the name. You were recently appointed to the seat. Your dad helped get it for you. Charlie could hear some quiet gasps from the audience and some rude guffaws, but he smiled indulgently. That's me, Charlie said, prompting some appreciative laughter. Perhaps you can help me understand something.
Perhaps, said Gaines.
You say the children who read your comics won't be swayed by the demonstrations of evil and gore since they know it's just a story.
Correct.
No impact on them at all, these lessons of how to kill your father and frame your mother because they won't buy you the doll you want.
None whatsoever.
And yet you say definitively that the lessons you preach against prejudice in those very same comics are absorbed by children.
We believe so, yes. These are basic lessons of morality.
So help me understand, why would the good lessons be heeded and the bad lessons ignored? Charlie asked. More murmurs erupted from the audience. The television cameraman pushed his lens closer to Gaines's face to catch the dramatic moment as he realized that he had just acknowledged that his comics had an influence on the behavior of children.
Very clever, Mr. Martyr, he finally said. But none of this hides the fact that this whole hearing is a sham.
It is? Charlie asked.
Yes, it is, Gaines said, growing agitated. It's a sham because children are being raised in poverty and squalor, and instead of focusing on the very real issues of prejudice and the historical legacy of slavery, you're looking at comic books.
We are looking at comic books. You're right about that, Charlie said. And while I don't disagree that juvenile delinquency is a multifaceted problem, some of it, maybe even most of it rooted in the conditions you just named, let us focus on the issue at hand. If one of the court clerks can please deliver this to Mr. Gaines. Gaines briefly examined the paper a clerk handed him, then raised an eyebrow.
And, Gaines said, irritated,
this is a page from your True Tales comic book from January 1953, issue number 237, correct?
I don't have the title page in front of me, Gaines said.
Oh, I'm sorry about that, said Charlie. Here's a copy of the comic book itself. Let's pass this over to Mr. Gaines. I have an extra.
Thank you, Gaines said, in a tone that was anything but grateful.
The first story in the comic is a 9-page tale of a boy using common household products to hurt an intruder.
You don't begrudge a child in a work of fiction defending himself, do you, Congressman Martyr? Surely you wouldn't prefer a comic where the intruder savages an innocent child.
Charlie chuckled. I wasn't aware those were the only two options, Mr. Gaines. The audience laughed. Charlie stole a quick peek at Kefauver, who was grinning like a proud papa. For those of you in the pews here, Charlie continued, prompting more chuckles, or those of you at home, he added, pointing with his pen to the camera lens, let me share some details about this comic. But unlike Mr. Gaines, I shall be judicious about what I share, since children might be watching. In one panel, the child combines two drain cleaners to burn the eyes of the intruder. With another common cleaning item, a polish that's very flammable, he sets the intruder on fire. These are barely disguised household products you likely have in your closets or underneath your kitchen sinks. I believe my wife and I have these in our home. in light of the irresponsibility of publishers such as Mr. Gaines and IC Comics, I would recommend that all the moms and dads out there either lock up household cleansers or put them on high shelves where children cannot reach them. The crowd was hanging on Charlie's every word. Gaines appeared confused, as if he were trying to figure out how to respond. My wife is pregnant, Mr. Gaines, and God willing, we will have more children after this one, and God willing, we will be able to figure out ways to prevent them from falling victim to your recklessness. There was silence, followed by a smattering of applause, but Gaines interrupted it. High and mighty, Gaines said. High and mighty. You want to talk about chemicals that are dangerous to children, Congressman Martyr? Gaines shifted in his seat and paused dramatically. Let's talk about chemicals dangerous to children. What about the General Kinetics plant being built in Harlem? Are those chemicals harmful to children? Hendrickson banged the gavel.
Mr. Gaines, Congressman Martyr is not a witness here.
Am I the only one under oath? Gaines shouted back. Why are our elected officials not required to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but?
It's okay, Senator. I can answer the question, Charlie said, secretly delighted that Gaines had taken the bait. Knowing of Gaines's membership in the local NAACP and his outspokenness against the proposed General Kinetics plant, Charlie had had a feeling the comic book publisher would bring a conversation about chemicals right to this very place.
You don't need to, Charlie, said Kefauver.
It's fine, Senators. Mr. Gaines, many of us have been working hard to prevent construction of the General Kinetics plant proposed for Harlem precisely because of the concerns you just raised.
Gaines was clearly unprepared for his bombshell to be diffused so swiftly. He said nothing.
In fact, said Charlie, as long as we're holding this hearing to protect the well-being of the American people, I should note that I recently came into possession of a dossier that once belonged to a friend of mine, the late Congressman Chris McLaughlin.
He reached into his briefcase as the senators at the main table conferred with one another, powerless to stop Charlie given the presence of the television cameras providing live coverage.
The dossier details a number of pesticide-producing chemical plants from Maine to Utah, from California to Florida, that are either controlled or owned by General Kinetics, and around which local populaces over the previous 20 years have experienced unusually high rates of cancer, nerve damage, and other severely debilitating illnesses.
The three rows of reporters covering the hearing were fiercely taking notes while citizen observers began buzzing among themselves. Kefauver rubbed his forehead. Hendrickson's face turned a shade of purple.
McLaughlin was investigating this matter until he was tragically killed on March 1st, and on his deathbed, he entrusted this information to me. This file contains memos and research proving that the pesticides being produced around the country to help this great nation grow its amber waves of grain, supported by taxpayer dollars via the Farm Bill I just co-sponsored, are poisoning Americans. Which explains everything from tumors in Mossville, Louisiana, to the thousands of dead sheep in Skull Valley, Utah.
Kefauver grabbed the microphone. Congressman Martyr, I'm sure there is a more appropriate time and place for this disclosure.
No, sir, said Charlie. This is a good time in front of these cameras to provide the American people with the unfiltered truth.
Hendrickson banged his gavel loudly.
We're going to take a break now. This hearing has veered wildly off course, he announced. 10 minutes, and when we return,
here he glared pointedly at Charlie,
we will address the issue for which this hearing was called.
The audience groaned.
How is this not the people's business? Shouted a reporter from the back bench.
Hendrickson didn't respond and stood to leave. Charlie grabbed his papers and rushed through the crowd and out the door. Pale journalists sporting fedoras and loud ties hounded Charlie down the hall and out the courthouse door like dogs pursuing a fox, seemingly oblivious to the pouring rain, shouting after him for copies of the documents he had wielded, for more information about General Kinetics, for a second of his time for an interview. He ignored them all and hopped into a black sedan idling in front of the courthouse steps. The driver, his father's chauffeur, smoothly and swiftly swerved away from the curb before the reporters could begin rapping on the windows. Charlie took a moment. The first blow had been struck. Now he needed to figure out how best to release all the damning information McLaughlin had dug up about the chemical plants, and find a path to escape the retaliation that would inevitably be coming his way. Chapter 25. Wednesday, April 21st, 1954. Afternoon. New York City and Susquehannock Island, Maryland. The White Horse Tavern stood at the corner of Hudson and 11th Streets in the West Village. Inside huddled beatniks and musicians, Columbia grad students and NYU co-eds, and self-styled working-class poets, all of them enveloped in a San Francisco fog of cigarette smoke. Each new arrival was announced by the ringing of a bell hanging above the door, followed by the sounds and winds of the thunderstorm barreling through Manhattan. The room reeked of soaking wet clothing and hair. It was afternoon, but it might as well have been 2 a.m., given the carousing and degree of inebriation in the crowd. In the back, on a stage illuminated by one hanging light bulb, a disheveled, hirsute young man in a corduroy jacket was reciting a poem he'd written. He paused to let the room appreciate his rhyme of ghetto and Geppetto. Charlie was at the White Horse for one simple reason, and it wasn't its bohemian chic. The tavern was a place where he could sit and chat with a black friend, without any hostile looks or comments. "Were you followed?" Charlie asked as Isaiah Street took off his wet hat and overcoat and hung them on a hook next to their corner booth.
"Not sure," Street said. "I might have had company on the train."
Charlie waved down the waitress, who promptly took their orders. 2 bourbons on the rocks, plus club sandwiches.
"Listen, I have some great news for you," Street said. "I mean, really great."
"What?" "God, I could use some great news, or even mediocre news. Anything other than horrible would be welcome." The waitress brought their drinks.
"To Dylan Thomas," Street said. "Death shall have no dominion."
Charlie raised his glass. Where better to toast him than in the place where he drank himself to death? They allowed their first few sips to settle.
"Did you get a chance to talk about the McLaughlin dossier at the hearings?" Street asked. "Bernstein told me that was your plan, but in the cab just now on the radio I didn't hear anything on the hearings."
"And you won't," boomed a nasal voice. Abner Lance, Chairman Carlin's right-hand man, loomed above them.
"Jesus, it's Count Orlok," said Charlie.
"There isn't going to be any press coverage of your lies and innuendo, Congressman," Lance told him.
"At least take a seat, Lance," said Street, "before you make a further spectacle of yourself."
Availing himself of an unoccupied chair at an adjacent table, Lance joined them.
"Quite a stunt there, Congressman," he said to Charlie.
Charlie shrugged. "I was asked a question. I answered."
"With a stolen dossier of classified information," said Lance.
"With data about the manufacture of pesticides that caused nerve damage and cancer," said Charlie, "to Americans."
"Why isn't this on the news, Abner?" Street asked.
"Because nobody wants it to be on the news. Not the Republicans, not the Democrats, not Wall Street, not the unions, no one. And when no one wants a story to be on the news, it has a way of not being on the news."
"A lot of reporters wanted to talk to me," Charlie said.
"They did," said Lance. "And now they don't."
He reached down to the floor for his briefcase. He opened it and withdrew a folder.
"Speaking of seeing print," he said, dropping the folder on the table in front of Charlie.
Charlie's heart sank.
"I assume you know what these are," Lance said. "Photographs of you behind the wheel of a wrecked car. Apparently a young woman was in your car with you, and she fell out as you recklessly and drunkenly careened the vehicle into a ditch."
Charlie felt as if his nerves had seized up, as if he were trapped in a body he couldn't move. He remembered having this feeling once before, for just a moment, during the war, when he listened to reports of Companies A and B of the 1st Battalion, 116th Infantry Regiment of the 29th Division, landing at Omaha Beach and getting mowed down by Germans like wheat cut by a scythe. Charlie and his men would soon enough be sent right into that same spray of death, he'd realized, and he sat as still as a statue until his first lieutenant snapped his fingers in front of his face, bringing him back. 11 years later, sitting in this smoky Greenwich Village tavern, Charlie snapped himself out of his shock.
"Do you want to see the photographs?" Lance asked.
Charlie eyed the folder apprehensively, formulating a response in his head. His mouth was as dry as a desert. He had chills. He wasn't sure if anyone else could see him shaking. He kept his hands on his lap to hide any tremors. Before he could speak, Street produced a file of his own. He dropped it on the table dramatically, then leaned back in his chair and exhaled a plume of cigarette smoke.
"Maybe you should take a gander at my photographs," Street said. "I took these myself."
Lance scoffed and made a show of unconcern, but he moved quickly to snatch the folder out of Charlie's reach, and as he shuffled through the photos inside, his face grew darker and the wrinkles in his scowl sank deeper, almost as if he were aging before Charlie's eyes. Carlin's top aide was already an odd-looking man on the best of days, with his red face and white blonde hair, a swollen bullfrog neck and fangish eye teeth. His current shock exacerbated the ugliness. Charlie desperately wanted to know what had sent Lance into such a rage, but he looked on placidly, betraying no sign of a heart beating fast enough to give Gene Krupa a run for his money, while a stifling heat built up inside his shirt collar. Charlie felt a heightened awareness of his surroundings. Somewhere, a waiter dropped a tray of dishes. The door opened, and the rain hitting the pavement sounded like a herd of porterhouses sizzling on the grill. The new customer passed their table, a peaty smell of wet wool wafting behind him. Charlie glanced at Street, who sat calmly, looking for all the world like a man holding a royal flush, waiting for his opponent to recognize defeat. Finally, Lance was finished with the photographs. He placed them gingerly on the table, face down, and then covered them with the folder. Charlie looked at Street, who could barely contain his smile. Lance stood.
"Very well, Congressman," he said. "I hope you've given full consideration to what this might mean."
"What it might mean?" asked Street. "You can't blackmail Charlie for something he didn't do. And those photographs prove the whole thing was a setup. You and LaMontagne arranged it all." He took a final gulp of his bourbon. "Good thing the 332nd Fighter Group of the United States Army Air Force has taught me night photography." He smiled benignly at Lance, whose face had turned a new shade of red. Charlie was stunned and starting to feel an ignition of fury. This whole time, Street had known that Charlie was an innocent man, and he hadn't bothered to tell him? But any resentment dissipated when Lance angrily sat back down.
"You little shits have no idea what you're doing or who you're dealing with," he said, his tone hushed and menacing. "You think it's cute that Charlie just alerted the Reds about our defoliation program, which we will need to protect allies and our own troops in the coming decades? You think you're heroes? You're not heroes. You're treasonous."
Charlie reached across the table to Street's pack of Pall Malls. He shook the box, loosened a cigarette, and lit it with his German lighter. He exhaled into Lance's face.
"Your chemicals are killing Americans, you insufferable worm," Charlie said. "Americans. In Utah and Appalachia and Mossville, Louisiana. They're poor Americans and colored Americans, so maybe you and Chairman Carlin and your friends at the club don't care. But I care. Isaiah cares. The guys we fought with in Europe, they care."
"Spare me the sermon, Eugene Debs," Lance spat. "If you want to go live in a socialist workers' paradise, feel free to fly to Moscow right now. You'll probably get a hero's welcome."
"You're just sore because we figured it out," Charlie continued, "and it was all right there in front of us." He withdrew a piece of paper from his wallet and tossed it in front of Lance. "New Chicago, 2, 4D, 2, 4, 5T, cereal grains, broadleaf crops. That was in my desk when I moved in, or should I say in Van Wagenen's desk. And it took me a while to piece it all together, especially since the University of Chicago wouldn't share the information about Mitchell and Krause's study. But as soon as we got hold of the General Kinetics dossier, we figured it out. 2,4-D is a fairly common herbicide. It kills weeds around cereal grains. No real mystery there. Until you combine it with 2,4-5-T, used to defoliate broadleaf plants, and the rest of what Van Wagenen found." Lance pointed his finger at Charlie as if it were a sword.
"Destroying brush where communist guerrillas hide will save lives," he said.
"And is that all the Army had discovered in its testing at Fort Detrick and Eglin Air Force Base?" Lance once again stood.
"We're done," he said. "I hope you have a good lawyer, and I hope your wives aren't home alone."
He left the table in the tavern with the speed and determination of a demon out of hell. Charlie and Street looked at each other, threw down money for the tab, and rushed to Pennsylvania Station to get to their wives as soon as possible. At the precise moment Lance was vaguely threatening Margaret, the rain, brutal and unrelenting, was beating down onto the tarp of Margaret's tent, and she was wondering how long the canvas would be able to withstand the assault. When she'd driven to the tip of the Maryland Isthmus, parked, and then crossed the bridge to Susquehannock Island by foot, she'd wondered if the weather would render the trip pointless. But she had no way of reaching Gwinnett, and she didn't want to disappoint him yet again. Almost 5 months into her pregnancy, this would be her last outing. Margaret had jogged across the bridge as quickly as she could with her slightly protruding abdomen, which meant she was soaking wet before she reached the halfway point, raincoat notwithstanding. She had guessed that by now Gwinnett, Kessler, and Cornelius would have moved to this new island, and she was right. They'd even moved her tent here. She felt thoroughly alone. unconnected to the researchers in the other three tents who didn't know yet that she had rejoined them, hundreds of miles away from her husband, with no way to reach him, isolated from the world. She could vanish right now, on this spot, and no one would realize it for hours, if not days. A few months ago, she might have reveled in that independence, but now, newly aware of menacing forces, she felt vulnerable. Her internal voice told her not to be so melodramatic, but then she reminded herself that these men in the Hellfire Club had tried to frame Charlie by killing a young woman, and were, at the very least, indifferent to the poisoning of Americans in the name of some greater struggle against the communists. They might even have killed Congressman Van Wagenen, for all she knew. She felt like Elizabeth Proctor in The Crucible, which Charlie had taken her to see shortly after it opened on Broadway. It was as if the whole world had gone mad. People who were normal, even friends, could be revealed as enemies, even evil. What was that line she had so liked from the play? "Remember, until an hour before the devil fell, God thought him beautiful in heaven." She looked at her few belongings in the tent, transported over and tossed inside. A small suitcase, a sleeping bag, a journal, her night vision binoculars. She was surprised to see the specialty binoculars in her tent, and she picked them up and held them. It felt like years since she'd left the birder emporium with them. Before this knowledge of everything Charlie was caught up in, a lifetime ago. Under the hiss of rain hitting the pines and the deeper pitched sizzle of the spray pounding the ground, a faint murmur of conversation made its way to her ears. One of the voices, Gwinnett's, was considerably louder than the others. She tried to focus, ignore the other noises, so she could make out what was being said, but to no avail. Without knowing exactly why she was being secretive, she walked stealthily, heel to toe, toward the sounds coming from Gwinnett's tent. The soil, a combination of hard-packed sand and dirt, had largely absorbed the water for hours, but saturation was now setting in, and small streams began swirling and trickling throughout the campsite. Twice a sustained gust of wind was strong enough to require Margaret to push her body against it to proceed on her path. "No sign of her yet," she heard Gwinnett say. "We're frankly not sure if she's coming back. Maybe not with this weather." She heard a gravelly but fainter voice now, sounding as if it was coming over a telephone, the shortwave radio Margaret had heard Gwinnett mention he had in case of emergency. "That's fine. Just know that the mission has now changed. Get us that dossier." "Understood. And where is he?" "Last seen in Manhattan." "What about her?" "We were tailing him, not her, so we lost visibility after she dropped him at the train station." The sharp crack of a bolt of lightning hitting somewhere on the island startled Margaret, though she was careful not to make a sound. Thunder growled deeply. "I can't even believe I can hear you with this storm," Gwinnett marveled. "Weather must be helping."
"Just get the girl."
"Folder," Margaret made out. The transmitter crackled with static, and the next words she could make out were,
"Now top priority."
"Of course," Gwinnett said. The noise of the transmitter ended abruptly. Margaret strained to hear Gwinnett's lowered voice.
"Go to the bridge and keep an eye out for her."
"Got it," said Cornelius. At the realization that Cornelius, too, was in the tent, and any second would be coming to find her, Margaret turned and fled. Chapter 26. Wednesday, April 21st, 1954. Evening. Susquehannock Island, Maryland. Margaret had trusted that Cornelius would follow orders and head right for the bridge, so she ran in the opposite direction. She knew it was a short-term solution. Cornelius would get to the bridge, cross it, and see her car parked nearby. As she'd anticipated, within 3 minutes of his leaving the tent, Cornelius returned from the bridge to the mainland and briskly walked right to Gwinnett and someone else, was it Kessler beneath that raincoat? Presumably to tell them that she might be on the island. The three began looking around. She guessed they were searching for her. That was 4 hours ago. Margaret lay on her side in a field of brush, sopping wet, watching the campsite, waiting for an idea or an opportunity. Gwinnett had returned to the campsite and now stood there with binoculars, searching for Margaret in the distance. She heard him instruct Cornelius and Kessler to run in opposite directions around the island, which they did, though so loudly that it wasn't difficult for Margaret to avoid them both. She was grateful the other two researchers, Quadrani and Hinman, were no longer there. At first, Gwinnett and his assistants attempted to appeal to her as if nothing was wrong. "Margaret, where are you?" they shouted, as if she'd gotten lost. As hours passed, however, and their frustration grew and the raging winds turned raindrops into pinpricks, they abandoned the pretense. "Margaret, come out!" Cornelius yelled. "There's nowhere for you to go. Kessler is at your car." And then, "You're going to die in this storm, Margaret. What worse could we do to you?"
She had slowly and silently negotiated the marsh and the wetlands. Fierce winds pushed ash and billowing thunderclouds across the sky without a break in sight. Night was coming, which complicated matters for both hunter and prey. They would not be able to see her, and she would not be able to see much beyond the lights of their camp. Every inch of her was wet, and she was knee-deep in the bog. She had never been so cold. Her jaw started to tremble, her teeth hitting each other. But it was too risky to move. Thank God she had been absent-mindedly holding her night-vision binoculars when she walked to Gwinnett's tent, she thought. They might save her life. Charlie and Street just made the train, the 5:15 evening congressional from New York to D.C., climbing aboard as it was starting to chug out of the station. Traffic had been especially bad in the rain. The line for tickets was long, and the sales clerk expressed skepticism that they'd make it. But they ran to and then alongside the slow-moving train until they found an open door and jumped on. Sweating, panting, they slowed their pace and found seats in the club car. After a waitress took their drink orders, Charlie finally asked the question. "So those were photographs of me, of that night?"
"Correct," said Street.
"What did they show?"
"Lance driving you to Rock Creek. Some other guy had already purposely crashed the car and placed the dead body by the side. He and Lance carried you to the spot and left. You woke up and LaMontagne showed up. He was cued to do so, I'm sure. The photos make it clear you weren't driving the car, that it was a setup."
The waitress returned with their drinks and Street bought a pack of cigarettes. Charlie stared out the window at industrial sites and trash-filled vacant lots, trying to take in all that he'd just learned. Street lit a cigarette and exhaled loudly. New Jersey swampland rushed past the window, and Charlie could see his reflection. He felt as if he'd aged 10 years in the past week, and he looked it, too.
"How long have you known this?" Charlie asked, irritated. "You said you took the pictures?"
"I don't know who took them," Street replied. "I said I took them, but that was a lie. Your dad gave them to me just before I met you at the White Horse Tavern. He had..."
"My dad?"
"Yes," Street said. "I don't know where they came from, but thankfully someone was tailing you that night." He lit another Pall Mall. "I don't know who took the pictures. For all I know, the Hellfire Club did it so they'd have leverage over Abner Lance and LaMontagne if they needed it. This is a weird and screwy group. And there appears to be a struggle going on within the Hellfire Club. Hoover and McCarthy and Ambassador Kennedy are on one side, the Dulles brothers and some other Ike allies are on the other."
"And what exactly is your role in it, Isaiah?" Charlie asked. "And why are you just now telling me about these pictures?"
He was trying to control the anger in his voice, without success. Street raised both hands in mild protest.
"Listen, I didn't know they even existed until this morning. Neither did your dad. I was going to tell you at the White Horse Tavern, but Lance showed up before I had a chance. Your dad called me first thing this morning and told me he'd managed to secure photographs that would be exculpatory. He said he was having them delivered to him this morning and I needed to come to his house to get them. He knew I was already coming up at your request. I met him, got the pics, then came to you. Ever since you told me about your predicament, your dad and I have been trying to figure out how to save you. Thank God his connection worked out."
Charlie looked down at the floor. Street took another drag from his cigarette. Charlie was silent, squinting at Street as he worked to piece things together. Outside, the rain beat down on another set of train tracks, beyond which leaned the shacks of the slums of Newark, New Jersey.
"So you're like a spy for my father?"
"No, no," Street protested. "You and I are friends. That's real, Charlie. But your father and I are affiliated, and we talk about things that have nothing to do with you."
"Affiliated how?" Charlie asked,
but Street only shrugged.
"That's not for me to say right now."
Charlie stared at him, then he stared out the window again. The train sped by a parallel roadside where signs, white on red and illuminated by individual lamps, had been hammered onto telephone poles. "Don't take a curve at 60 per. We hate to lose a customer. Burma Shave." The sky was a ceiling of black and gray clouds. Thick sheets of rain looked like ink stains in the distant horizon. A bolt of lightning flashed and then crackled several miles away, making the cloud behind it glow a bright yellow, as if it were a pinball machine tilt.
"We're all on the same side here, Charlie," Street finally said. "Your father should be the one to tell you anything more. He'll be furious at me if he finds out that I told you even this much."
"You haven't told me anything!" Charlie exclaimed angrily. Street shook his head.
"I'm sorry, I just cannot say anything more right now. Just know there are good people looking out for you."
At this point, Charlie wasn't sure if there was anyone he could trust other than Margaret. Even his father had been withholding information. The train continued on its southern path to Baltimore, with Washington at the end of the line.
The cloak of night had fallen on Susquehannock Island. The only light emanated from a flickering lamp inside Gwinnett's tent and the two dim flashlights Cornelius and Kessler held at their hips. But through her night vision binoculars, Margaret could see just enough. Cornelius stood on the bridge to the mainland. Kessler stayed in the wooded area between the bridge and the camp. She was grateful she had the binoculars, though all they accomplished right now was to highlight the extent of her predicament. Short of swimming off the island, which in this storm was too great a risk, she was trapped, unless she could get them to move, which would require a diversion. But what? Determined not to give in to her fear, she tried to remain focused. Her only option was to get off the island before the storm subsided and the sun rose. She began moving west, to her left, crouching low to the ground, trying to be as quiet as possible, though her sloshing in the bog was drowned out, even to her own ears, by the roar and thunder of the storm. She stood slowly, taking cover behind an elm, and used the binoculars to follow the green glow of Gwinnett's body heat as he walked from the tent to the bridge. The other two men had turned off their flashlights, but she could still make them out in the distance. She considered running to her tent, where she knew she had a knife in her supply kit. Could she make it there and out without them seeing her? It seemed too great a chance. She sensed something to her right. It started as a feeling, then she heard a sound. She turned the binoculars away from the men and saw a giant, glowing green mass speeding toward the researchers. It was barreling through the rising waters that had formed in a field of salt marsh cordgrass. It took Margaret a second to make out the individual parts of the immense shape. The ponies. It was impossible to get a precise count, but there were maybe 100 of them, all galloping from the wooded part of Susquehannock Island toward the men standing near the bridge. The stampede had started for no discernible reason beyond a storm that had been raging for half the day. Gwinnett shouted something Margaret couldn't make out in the tempest, and through the binoculars she saw the other two green shapes turn to see the ponies running toward them, and then the men began to run in three different directions. With the stampeding ponies several yards to her right, Margaret, her agility and speed compromised by the pregnancy, jogged alongside them, running through the brush and onto the northern shore as the ponies continued their charge. The storm, while steady and intense, hadn't noticeably increased in the past few minutes. Panic was the only explanation she could imagine. She jogged behind a scrub pine tree, then looked around for any sign of a human as the last of the herd, foals mainly, accompanied by their mothers, galloped past her. Margaret realized that the distraction of the stampede might be her only chance to escape the island. She was about to sprint toward the bridge when she saw Gwinnett emerge from behind a shrub thicket maybe 10 feet away. She didn't need her night vision binoculars to see him. He was close enough that she could see him scowling at her with a look of menace she'd never seen before. She stopped in her tracks and unconsciously reached under her shirt to pat her abdomen, to reassure herself that the baby was okay, and also to calm herself. Her swollen belly felt perfectly fine, but the shock of her ordeal caused her to shake. A wave of nausea hit her, and as she gasped, she was stunned by a bright strobe of light, and, 1 second later, a loud crack. She thought lightning had struck, but the lightning bolts that had struck the sea and the island over the previous few hours had been clear bolts zigzagging from the sky with deliberate speed. This was just a circle of light that flashed from the bridge, and it was followed by Gwinnett, falling, limply, back into the thicket. Then she saw someone was on the bridge with a gun. Margaret squinted as the beam from a powerful flashlight blinded her. "Don't move," a voice commanded. A woman's voice. The streets outside Baltimore's Pennsylvania Station were being pounded with torrential rains, and taxicabs were scarce. When Charlie finally found one, the grizzled hack wouldn't consider any sum to make the drive all the way out to the bridge to Susquehannock Island. "Never," he said, chomping on his cigar. "And you ain't gonna find no one willing to do it in this weather, not no one." The prediction proved correct, and soon enough Charlie was at the local Hertz auto rental office, where he was offered a black 1951 Studebaker Commander. "The last time I was in a Studebaker was that night in Rock Creek," Charlie thought. And then he corrected himself, since he now knew he hadn't been in the car that night at all. When he was here a month ago, the journey via taxi had taken an interminable 3.5 hours. Driving himself, he could theoretically drive faster and more recklessly, but with accidents and flooding from the storm, it took him 5 hours, an insufferably frustrating trek that reminded Charlie of a recurring nightmare he'd had in high school, in which no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't reach an object that he desperately needed to. As he neared the bait shop, he saw in the distance not only his car, which Margaret had driven there, but three others parked on the shoulder between the store and the footbridge. One car had its lights on and was still running. Charlie turned off his lights and pulled over to the side of the road. At first, Margaret didn't recognize the woman. Her head was shrouded in the hood of a dark poncho. She looked like a sinister nun. But then the woman lowered her lamp and came closer, and Margaret realized who had just shot Gwinnett. "Make sure he's dead," Catherine Leopold said. Stunned, Margaret obeyed, hustling to the thicket where Gwinnett had fallen. She reached into the brambles and pulled him up by the back of the neck. His head was heavy and lifeless. No breath, no movement, no pulse. She gently released him back into the bush. "What on earth is happening?" she thought. "Why is Miss Leopold holding a gun?" "He's dead," Margaret said, still reeling from the intensity of the night, all ending with the shock of seeing Leopold. She was, of course, relieved that Gwinnett was no longer chasing her down. But why did Leopold shoot him? And who was she with? Leopold turned to two other figures standing behind her, men that Margaret hadn't focused on until now. "Go find the others," she told them, and they hustled past Margaret onto the island. From under her poncho, Leopold produced a cigarette, but she struggled to light it in the rain. She finally ducked completely into the poncho like a turtle, and then reemerged with it lit. Margaret braced herself to ask. "Why? He was a threat to you, your Dr. Lewis Gwinnett," Leopold interrupted, exhaling her cigarette smoke. "He wanted the dossier, of course. Where is the dossier, Margaret?" No more Mrs. Martyr. Such formalities were no longer called for, apparently. Margaret had so many questions. "At the house," she replied. "The dossier is at our house. We made a photocopy. Charlie has the original." Leopold nodded. It all seemed impossible, this scene. Catherine Leopold holding a gun, while they stood there soaking wet, minutes after the pony stampeded. Gwinnett, who just hours ago had gone from seductive to menacing, dead in a bush just feet away. Margaret tried to make sense of it, but couldn't. She tried to appeal to Catherine, figuring it was her only chance. "Thank you for saving me, Catherine," she said. The rain poured down on her face as if she were standing beneath a fire hose. "He and his goons were chasing me all over the island." "Gwinnett was a communist agent," Leopold said. "Did you know he was a communist?" "Yes, no, I mean, I suspected he had those sympathies from comments he'd made here and there. But frankly, it's not all that unusual in academia. I never thought he took any action. But then a few hours ago I overheard someone on a radio telling him to get the dossier and to get me, so I ran and hid." Leopold took a deep drag of her cigarette. "We've been following him for the past month, since we picked up shortwave radio chatter about you," she said. "You must have heard some of that as well." "We?" Margaret asked. "We've been following him for the past month?" "Hoover," she said. "I should be more precise. The FBI. Hours ago, they picked him up talking to a Soviet agent. He was told to get the file at any cost. The feds put out an APB for him. And, of course, Chairman Carlin and the others were also alerted. Through the club. I knew his whereabouts because we've also been monitoring you and your house."
"Can we get out of the rain?"
Margaret asked. She shivered. "In a minute. We need to wait for them to finish the job." They stood there in the darkness, rain beating on them relentlessly. Leopold flicked her cigarette into the brush. "You put yourself, your husband, and your country at great risk today." She stared at Margaret with her enormous blue eyes, which right now conveyed fury. "I don't mean to sound harsh, but you are a very foolish woman." From a distance came a bang and then the echo of a gunshot, then another one, seemingly from the other side of the island. Margaret was terrified. Her mouth was dry and her limbs felt heavy. Worried about her baby, Margaret touched her abdomen underneath her shirt again.
"I don't understand," said Margaret, trying to keep the conversation friendly, trying not to sound alarmed. "All three of them were communist agents? I thought Kessler and Cornelius were just grad students."
Leopold shrugged. "The Bureau has been monitoring Gwinnett since the late 1940s. He'd been recruited years before, likely by Hiss. He'd been recruiting and had also been tasked with pursuing, friendships with susceptible young women in proximity to power. Your father-in-law was the long-game target, we assume. But then Charlie was appointed to Congress, and your star rose even higher." She gestured with her left arm, indicating the landscape. "This entire research project was funded by Mother Russia, so Gwinnett could get close to you while Charlie was in Congress."
"But why? Charlie's just a freshman."
"The Reds have tentacles throughout the government, everywhere, and Charlie's been the focus of a lot of groups, clubs and associations, the commies, the Hellfire Club, other competing interests. Folks want to be close to the son of Winston Martyr.
and when Charlie tried to stop the funding to Goodstone, he showed a certain egoism, a selfishness, early on, that Chairman Carlin and others in the club knew needed to be stopped.
"Can't have too many folks trying to do the right thing, I suppose," Margaret said.
"You and your idiot husband wouldn't know the right thing if it bit you squarely on the nose," Leopold said. "You think you're keeping us safe? From what? The engine of our economic boom? From the makers of weapons that will protect us and prevent communism from spreading here? I know you're kind. You sneer at Joe McCarthy while he ferrets out the traitors in our midst. You turn your nose up at the workers who slave away at General Kinetics plants, but you enjoy their products and the safety they afford you and your unborn baby."
Margaret felt her heart skip a beat. Is this really Catherine Leopold? A trained killer?
She wondered if Leopold's smiling, efficient, aging beauty queen persona had ever been legitimate. Margaret tried to appeal to her vanity by treating her like an expert.
"Why would the Reds even want the dossier?" Margaret asked. "Why would Gwinnett be chasing me down like that? I don't understand."
"We don't know if they intended to leak the information to their lackeys in the press, or more likely whether they were planning some sort of combination of espionage and sabotage, learning as much as they can about the chemical plants and destroying them when need be. The Soviets' ability to recruit spies has been depressingly efficient."
"I want you to know, I appreciate you're trying to help Charlie, trying to steer him away from this madness,"
Margaret said, hoping her ploy to appeal to her captor wasn't too obvious. "I did for him what I tried to do for Van Wagenen. I gave him advice on how to succeed on Capitol Hill and do right by the American people. Neither one took my advice, with predictable results." The two men she'd sent off hustled back from their tasks.
"Should we go?" one of them asked Miss Leopold.
"Indeed. Put Margaret here in the back seat. Tie her hands and have her sit between the two of you. I'll drive."
At the sound of the first gunshot, Charlie had instinctively crouched into soldier position as if he were back in France. Except, he immediately realized, he was without a weapon. He ran to the left, to the bank, as far as he could to escape from the beam of the one idling car's taillights, and then slowly walked toward the bridge. He saw shapes on the island, barely illuminated by the car's headlights, dissipating in the downpour. There were three figures, two larger men and one smaller shape. The two bigger silhouettes suddenly ran in opposite directions, out onto the island, one to the left and the other to the right. Charlie took his chance and scurried under the bridge. The footbridge from the mainland to Susquehannock Island spanned roughly 500 feet, short enough to swim at a normal time, but too far now, given the swift current. Charlie held up the flame of his lighter to inspect the underside of the bridge. A stabilizing beam ran its length with perpendicular bars roughly every 10 feet. He could probably have made it across when he was at peak army fitness a decade ago, but attempting to complete such a challenge today seemed mad. And yet, what choice did he have? Charlie put the lighter back in his pocket, then took off his overcoat and suit jacket and dropped them on the muddy bank under the bridge. He rolled up his sleeves and jumped up to the first perpendicular bar, which he was relieved to find was relatively dry. His grip was firm and felt steadier than he'd anticipated. Good. He swung himself back and forth like a trapeze artist until his body was parallel with the ocean and he could hook one leg around the long beam that undergirded all 500 feet of the bridge. With his back to the ocean, he began to shimmy across. About halfway along, he could faintly make out two women's voices, one of them Margaret's, though their tones were too low for him to discern what they were saying. As he continued, he heard a gunshot, and he froze, suspended above the churning waters. He started moving at an increased pace and soon heard another blast of gunfire. After what seemed like an eternity, he heard his wife speak again. As he approached the island, one set of heavy footsteps clomped on the footbridge above him, then a second set, then more. He heard Margaret's voice as she crossed the bridge above his head. When Charlie arrived on Susquehannock Island, he jumped to the ground, poked his head out, and saw four people walking briskly in the other direction, returning to the mainland. In the light of the car, the silhouettes of the men revealed their guns, as did the woman's. She spoke, and Charlie recognized Leopold's voice. Her gun was resting at the small of Margaret's back.
Chapter 27. Thursday, April 22, 1954. Early morning. Capitol Hill. A few hours after he got home, Isaiah Street was almost relieved to be awoken by the pounding on his front door, even though, according to his watch, it wasn't yet 5 a.m. He'd been in the grasp of his recurring nightmare, reliving the time the Tuskegee Airmen of the 332nd Fighter Group lost some of the B-24s they were escorting on a bombing run. Struck by German bombers flying in formation, eight of the B-24s were hit by Luftwaffe fire over Nîmes, France. Three crashed. From his cockpit, he'd watched two of the planes go down. He saw only three airmen able to secure their parachutes and jump. Rene murmured something inaudible. Street pulled the covers over her shoulders and reached for his bathrobe, then jogged to the door to stop the knocking before it woke the twins. Eye to the peephole, he wasn't entirely surprised to see Charlie, disheveled, with a panicked expression discernible even through the tiny distorted lens. Street opened the door, stepped out onto the front stoop, and closed the door gently behind him. Charlie dispensed with greetings. His face was a study in pure terror. "They have Margaret." Street gripped Charlie by both shoulders. "Stay calm." He could see Charlie's panic rising. "It's the only way to help her." Street shook him gently. "She's going to be okay. Just let me get dressed." "I'll be in that car," Charlie said, pointing to the black Hertz Studebaker Commander parked in front of Street's modest townhouse, illuminated by a street lamp. "If you have a gun, bring it."
"I have two," Street said.
3 minutes later, Street was dressed and in the car. Charlie hit the gas and raced through the remnants of the storm. He told Street about the events of the night. After Leopold and her two thugs had driven away with Margaret, Charlie had run across the bridge to his rental car. Headlights turned off, Charlie trailed them for miles, a task made a bit easier by the storm, which kept Leopold from driving as fast as she no doubt would have otherwise. "I followed them all the way back to Washington," Charlie said. "Around the Bay Bridge, there was enough traffic for me to turn my lights on and blend in." Charlie turned left onto Pennsylvania Avenue southeast. The street was dark and empty, the sun not yet risen. The disquieting hour before dawn, when it feels as if no one else is alive. The stillness was interrupted by the click-clack sound of Street loading an odd-looking pistol that resembled a flare gun, with room for bullets in the pistol grip. Street caught Charlie's uneasy glance. "What the hell is that?" "It's an FP-45 Liberator," Street told him. "The only guns I have here. I have others back in Chicago. It's designed to look like a flare gun, but it ain't. Mainly used by OSS during the war."
"You were OSS? Clandestine Services?"
"I'm a Tuskegee Airman. You know that," Street said.
"Okay, but were you also OSS?
Street paused and then said, "Yes, I was. And I'm also still in a branch of former OSS, who continue to serve in our way. We can talk about that later. Where are we going?"
Charlie raised an eyebrow at his friend and was ready to press him further, but was distracted by the view of the immense domed silhouette looming five blocks ahead.
"I saw them take her into the Capitol," he said.
The attack by the Puerto Rican nationalists was apparently not enough to warrant increased security before dawn, since only one Capitol Hill police officer roamed the grounds outside the Capitol building. Charlie and Street saw him off in the distance, on the Senate side as they pulled up. The cop briefly turned and considered their car, Charlie's rented Studebaker, but then seemed to recognize Charlie as he exited the vehicle and looked back in the other direction. Members of Congress were given a wide berth to do whatever they wanted. Street discreetly handed Charlie one of the two OSS guns he'd brought. Charlie tucked the dossier on General Kinetics at the small of his back under his shirt, and with the gun in his right hand, he led the way into the Capitol. They first entered the Rotunda Crypt, a round room on the first floor containing 13 statues representing historic figures from each of the original colonies. Red light from an exit sign exposed Robert E. Lee's mournful gaze as Charlie and Street ran between the Doric columns in the center of the room, then took a left to exit the crypt. They rushed past a giant bust of George Washington and softly hustled their way up a curved stone staircase to the second floor. The rotunda was dimly lit by small lamps built into the circular wall. Normally, daylight flooded the room through the dome windows 180 feet above them, but at this early hour, with cloud cover, visibility was dim. Charlie knew that 12 statues of various founding fathers and former U.S. presidents stood like guards throughout the room, but all he could see were their immense looming shapes. The details of the 8 paintings displayed, enormous renderings of American explorers from Columbus to Daniel Boone, were all but invisible. Charlie and Isaiah stood silently for a second. The Senate side of the Capitol was to their right, the House side to their left. Street leaned close to Charlie.
"Do you have any idea where they took her?"
he whispered.
"No," Charlie said. "I saw them go through the door we just came through, and then I went to get you."
"Smart soldier," Street said. "Let's split up. Meet back by this doorway in 15 minutes. You go to Statuary Hall. I'll head toward the Senate side."
"Roger,"
Charlie whispered. Street fell back and disappeared into the darkness. Charlie drew his FP-45 Liberator and held it with two hands. He walked carefully along the walls of the rotunda, heel to toe, making as little noise as possible. After passing by the statues he believed to be Thomas Jefferson and Theodore Roosevelt, he took a left out of the rotunda and into National Statuary Hall. He had been holding his terrors about Margaret at bay, focused as he was on his mission to save her. In this, he instinctively relied on the muscle memories of his days as an army captain in the war, the ability of a soldier in life-or-death situations to cram unhelpful emotions in a box. But the war was 9 years ago, and he was a different man now, a softer man. He started to tremble as his fears for Margaret crept into his consciousness. Suddenly aware of his shaking legs, Charlie made himself stop short. There was no time for such indulgences, for fear or self-pity. He needed to finish this mission. Statuary Hall was better lit than the rotunda, and Charlie could make out some of the faces on the vast array of sculptures, men whom he and Street had been arguing about just a few months ago. Georgia Governor Alexander Stevens, the Vice President of the Confederacy. Mississippi's Jefferson Davis, its President. The men containing multitudes. Charlie shook his head as he recalled making that remark. He walked softly on the black-and-white checkered marble floor as he moved along the edge of the room, stepping on the tile dedicated to James Polk. The faces of the statues, shrouded in shadow, were doleful, like guests at a funeral. He wondered what Street was finding, how much time had passed. He checked his watch. Only 5 minutes. He quickened his pace, making his way out of the room and into the hall that went to the house chamber. As he approached a narrow stairwell leading downstairs, he suddenly felt a metal object poking his back as he heard a voice. "Hello, Charlie." His heart skipped. Phil Strongfellow was behind him, with a gun, presumably, one whose muzzle was now nestled firmly against his back. Charlie raised his hands in the air. "Hi, Strong," Charlie said. "What is this you've got, a flare gun?" Strongfellow asked, half curious, half mocking, as he took it from Charlie's hand. "It's an OSS gun, Strong," Charlie said, turning his head to the right to see Strongfellow behind him. "Designed to look like a flare gun, but it's not." Strongfellow didn't react. "Odd that you wouldn't know that," Charlie said. "I mean, given your illustrious history in the clandestine services. According to This Is Your Life, I mean." Charlie felt Strongfellow shove the butt of his gun more sharply into his back. "Fuck off, Charlie," he said. "Move. We're going downstairs." Charlie proceeded slowly down two flights of stairs, turning his head to get a look at Strongfellow, who, he noticed, still had a limp, but was no longer using crutches. "Where are your crutches?" "Shut up, Charlie," Strongfellow snapped. "You wouldn't want to risk me getting agitated. I might trip, causing an accidental discharge of my firearm." In the basement of the Capitol, Strongfellow guided Charlie through a labyrinth of unlit hallways. "Where are we going?" "To your wife. If you're lucky, they'll let you swap the dossier for her." "Why would they let me live?" Charlie asked. He didn't expect an answer, and he didn't get one. They passed storage rooms and the occasional maintenance closet, went down one hall, then another. They came across a stairwell leading them down an additional flight, though Charlie hadn't known until then that there was a floor lower than the basement in the Capitol building. At the bottom of that stair, Strongfellow guided them to the right, down a long hall so dark all Charlie could see were the two closed oak doors at the end of it. Their footsteps echoed above the dull hum of the generator as they finally arrived at their destination. On one of the wooden doors was written, "Storage." "Open it and keep your hands up," Charlie was told, and he obeyed. The expansive room was filled with statues, 50 or more. In front of one, honoring Confederate Congressman John Tyler, a former U.S. president who'd backed the wrong horse in the Civil War, stood Margaret, her mouth gagged with a cloth, her hands tied behind her back with a rope, her pregnant belly moving rapidly in time with her breathing. To her left, leaning against a sculpture of Aaron Burr, stood Chairman Carlin, his arms crossed. To her right stood Leopold and the two thugs Charlie had seen out on Susquehannock Island. "Honey, you okay?" Charlie asked Margaret. "She's fine," Miss Leopold answered for her. "For now." "Congressman Marta, you've proven to be quite the irritant," Carlin said. "Phil, did you check to see if he has the General Kinetics dossier with him?" "Not yet," said Strongfellow. He approached Charlie from behind, frisked him, and easily located the dossier under his shirt. Strongfellow removed and inspected it, then handed it to Carlin. The chairman looked at the dossier, then raised his eyes to meet Charlie's. His voice was low, the menacing tone unmistakable. "Do you have any idea how much damage you could have done to the security of this nation? By exposing pesticide plants that are literally killing your fellow Americans?" Charlie asked. "Might as well tell him, Mr. Chairman," someone behind Charlie said. "If he's not ever going to leave here, maybe he should know just how out of his depth he's been this whole time." Street's voice.
Charlie looked around and saw his friend lighting a cigarette, his gun in one hand, as casual as a summer breeze.
"There you are, Isaiah," said Carlin. "I was wondering when you were going to show up."
Chapter 28. Thursday, April 22nd, 1954. Early morning, Capitol Hill.
"Oh, my God," Charlie said, and he looked to Margaret, whose eyes widened in disbelief.
Carlin and Leopold chuckled. The two thugs stayed silent. Strongfellow looked as if he wished he weren't there. Street ambled casually into the room, cigarette in one hand, OSS gun in the other. He stopped next to a statue, looked up, and regarded the likeness of Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest, the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. He smirked and pulled himself up to sit on the statue's marble pedestal, then ashed his cigarette on General Forrest's boots.
"You want to know why?" Street said, looking at Charlie.
"He's not entitled to know anything," Leopold said.
"I want to know everything," said Charlie, turning his gaze to Carlin. "And start at the beginning. Did you have Van Wagenen killed?"
"You don't have to tell him, Franklin," Leopold said.
"Franklin?"
said Charlie, noting the unusual use of Carlin's first name.
"Go ahead and explain it, Mr. Chairman," Street said.
"We never meant for Charlie to get tangled up in any of this, and certainly not Margaret."
"Of course not," said Leopold. "I did everything I could to try to steer him in the right direction. But you wouldn't listen, Congressman."
"Martin Van Wagenen had figured out what you're doing," said Charlie. "That's why he's dead, isn't it?"
"Martin Van Wagenen is dead because he was even more treasonous than you," Carlin spat. "Someone at the Pentagon told him about the University of Chicago study by Mitchell and Krauss, how a defoliant could be used as a weapon against the Reds. And then he started looking into all of it. He had all these connections at the Pentagon and in corporate America that he'd picked up on the Truman Commission. Thankfully, our connections quickly told us what was going on, and we positioned one of our Hellfire Club nuns right next to him so she could keep us abreast of everything the whole time."
Leopold nodded, lips pursed.
"That's correct," she said. "And just like Congressman Martyr, Congressman Van Wagenen ignored me and thought he was somehow above it all and that all of those working so hard to save this country from the Red Menace were its enemies."
"Which reminds me, Charlie," said Carlin, "you owe Miss Leopold and our security team here a thank you for saving your wife's life. Louis Gwinnett had orders from his Soviet friends to do whatever he needed to get those files on the General Kinetics plants. I have no doubt he would have killed her."
"As you're about to," Charlie said.
Carlin shrugged.
"At least this way you get to say goodbye."
Charlie glanced at Margaret, who looked terrified.
"What do you mean goodbye?" Strongfellow asked.
"By that, Chairman Carlin means that he intends to kill Charlie and Margaret," Street said.
"Or have them killed, by you or me, or those two meatballs over there."
He pointed at the two thugs next to Leopold, who shot Street angry looks.
"Speaking of which, bring me my gun, the one you took from Charlie."
Street hopped down from the statue and held out his hand. Strongfellow looked around the room in disbelief. He walked slowly toward Street and handed him the OSS gun he'd taken from Charlie.
"Let me see yours, too," Street said.
Strongfellow handed over his .38. Street opened its chamber, clicked it back in place, and felt the weight of the piece in his palm.
"I've seen the Smith & Wesson's Chief Special before, but I've never fired one," Street said to Strongfellow, as if he were at a cocktail party. "Feels good."
"You'll get to use it in a second," Carlin said.
"Lies rubiat skepi letiat,"
Leopold said to Charlie.
"That's what Lenin said. To chop down a forest, splinters will fly."
"Or in American, you can't make an omelet without cracking some eggs," said Carlin. "Forgive Catherine, she loves to show off how much she learned when she was undercover for military intelligence in Moscow."
Margaret tried to speak, but they couldn't understand her through the gag.
"What's she saying?" asked Strongfellow.
"Go ahead and remove that, Catherine," Carlin said. After Margaret swallowed, she spoke.
"Love the notion of an anti-communist quoting Lenin," she said.
"Should I put the gag back on?" asked Leopold.
"Margaret's right, it's perfect," said Charlie.
"To chop down a forest, splinters will fly. So they'll fly into me and Margaret, right? Who cares?
But how many splinters are flying?
General Kinetics is manufacturing this pesticide to spray all over insurgencies around the world, and the people and livestock dying here in the U.S. are just collateral damage? That's what this is about? Is this pesticide really worth it?"
"You halfwit, these aren't pesticides," Carlin snarled.
"We're making chemical weapons."
"You really think all of this is about defoliation?" said Leopold. "This is about the next century's worth of warfare. Nukes probably won't ever be used in our war against the Soviets or the Chinese. We will fight conventional wars, and we cannot afford another loss like in Korea, so we need a better way to fight.
Chemical weapons were outlawed after World War I, Charlie said.
Which is why a chemical weapon disguised as a defoliant is so brilliant, said Leopold.
You're sick, said Margaret. You're sociopaths. Innocent people might die.
They already have, said Street.